Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live, weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Angela Davis, and this is NPR News. Last week, I had a chance to interview the host of 1A, Jen White. We hear her voice on NPR News every weekday morning at 10, and I just had a chance to ask her some questions about her job, the future of journalism, and the pandemic we're all living through. Jen, so nice to meet you, even if it is virtual.
I think most of my meetings have been happening virtually for quite some time now, I'm accustomed to it, but it's great to be here with you all.
So, Jen, first of all, I'm just curious, you know, how you're doing during this pandemic. We're about 8 months into it now. A lot of us are dealing with what, you know, people are calling pandemic fatigue. I know that I feel worn out most days. So how are you doing?
Wow, that's... That's a complicated question with a complicated answer. You know, we made this decision to move to DC during the pandemic. And when we made that decision, it was without knowing how long this was going to last. And so moving to a new city, moving into a new job, that would be stressful under the best of circumstances. Under these circumstances, it's been particularly challenging. We're fortunate in that we do have community in the DC area. So we have friends and family here, and not that we're able to see them. There is a sense of connection that we moved into. But it has been challenging to get to know a new team remotely. Most of our team is working from home. Mm-hmm. I haven't met every member of our team face-to-face yet. It's been mostly over Zoom. And doing this work at a time when the country is so divided, mm-hmm, is hard. It's a hard job to do. All that being said, I'm grateful that I get to be a part of a show that's convening really important conversations for our country right now. And I think for me and a lot of my friends who work in the news, we're all just working really hard to do our jobs, but also maintain the balance that's necessary to care for ourselves and our families. So it's a really complicated time, really complicated time.
It's a lot of pressure. I think I wake up each morning feeling, you know, a lot of pressure, feeling like the platform that I have as a talk show host, I have an opportunity to educate people, to make people, you know, help people form, you know, more, or I guess, for more informed opinions. Do you feel like sort of carry that weight as well? Like, I got to get this right.
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, it's not even just getting it right. That's definitely the lion's share of it. But 1A is a show where people know their voices and their opinions can be shared. But people are feeling so many things so deeply right now. Anger, fear. There's some joy mixed in there too, but there's also despair. And hosting a show where we make room for all of that, there's a lot of responsibility that goes along with it. I think it's really important to approach this work with empathy and humanity, but there is a weight that goes along with being the convener of those conversations and being the filter for those deep emotions and trying to provide a space where people can express themselves, but also, you know, get answers to questions that they have. Yeah, there's a lot that goes along with it. Yeah.
Because I feel like a lot of people are still kind of walking on eggshells right now. Like they're processing their thoughts and how they feel about what's happening in the nation, but also trying to assess, like, are you a safe person to talk to, or am I going to start something by telling you how I really feel?
Yeah. And that's, you know, this is a tricky thing with our show. You know, it's 1A, right? So you have the freedom to speak freely. But while we really think that's important on our show, we're also mindful of the fact that people don't necessarily want to hear the thoughts, feelings of folks who don't agree with them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And when they do hear from people who they don't share beliefs with, we hear about it, you know. So I'm also really mindful, not just of my role as host, but of how my producers are doing, you know, because they are sort of the first line of, I don't want to use of a defense, it's not exactly the right term, but they're the people who get that information first, right? As they're going through social media feedback or going through emails or voicemails or screening calls, they get it first, and then it comes to me on the show. And so I'm also really mindful of how they're all doing right now.
So let's talk a little bit about the behind the scenes and that collaborative effort. I think one of the things I enjoy most about my job as a talk show host is that I get to bounce ideas off of the producers. I get to hear their ideas and then how we as a team come together and figure out, like, this could be good. Explain how it works and how you guys come up with ideas and then select guests and then try to get everybody available and on the line at the same hour.
Right. So we have we have three editorial calls Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. So 8 o'clock in the morning, everybody's on a call talking about that day's show. Mm-hmm. You know, has anything changed overnight? Is there any new information we need to include in the conversation that we didn't know previously? Once we get through that, then we quickly touch on what's happening on the show the next day. That happens in about the space of a half hour. At noon, we do a postmortem call. So right after the show, everybody convenes again over Zoom. Normally, we'd be in a room together talking about this. But we get together on Zoom and just sort of go through the show, what worked, what didn't work, what opportunities did we miss? Were there voices that should have been a part of the conversation that weren't? And then 3 days a week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, we do a larger pitch meeting. So we do a 2:30 call where everyone gets together. They pitch their ideas. So a rule we have for those pitches is that you have to have guests to suggest as well. So you can't say, I've got this great idea. It's about space.
Right.
It's like, okay, well, who's going to be part of that conversation? Right. And so that's the time when we really try to, like, drill down into whether it's a fully fleshed out idea or not. Or whether it needs some more workshopping before it's really a workable show. And we have such a range of producers on the show with a wide variety of interests. And sometimes it gets workshopped in real time and we say, okay, well, I hear that that's the conversation, but maybe it's more this conversation that's a little adjacent to what you were thinking. And sometimes we work it out right there on the call. Other times it's like, okay, it sounds like you've got the grain of something there. Go back, think about it for a little bit longer and try to refine this, you know, like, what is the key question you're trying to answer? Who are the people who need to be a part of this conversation? You know, is this going to be something that, you know, is just going to appeal to a certain section of our audience, or is there a way to broaden the conversation so that even if it's not something you're familiar with, there's a place for you to hook into it.
Right.
And so that happens, you know, 3 days a week.
I love it in our pitch meetings when a producer will offer up something. I'm like, what does that mean? Is that what the young people are doing? What are you talking about? And I find those often can be the best shows because I am, like, completely clueless, yeah. But I'm trusting the team to, you know, help me with the preparation for it. And so I feel like if it's new to me, it may be new to a lot of people.
We did a show recently about, it's probably a month or two ago. I don't know when. Time has no meaning anymore. But it was on cottagecore. And when the producer initially pitched it, I was like, I do not know what that is. And so she explained, and it ended up being this really fun conversation about how, you know, people on Instagram, primarily younger people, are really tapping into this nostalgia and creating this sort of alternate, almost alternate universe that's all about peace and simplicity.
Arts and crafts. And
funny,
and, yeah, I heard that.
Is that my niece called me, she's 15, and she called me after the show and she said, "Auntie, I loved the cottagecore conversation. I'm so into frogs right now." And then we just had this whole other conversation about cottagecore with a 15-year-old who's listening to NPR. And I just, right. I just love the idea that I love, like, I learned something through that show. I had no frame of reference for it. But then I was also able to have this conversation with my niece because it was already an area of interest for her. So yeah, I love being surprised on the show. I love when I'm learning about something along with people who are listening.
But Jen, isn't that the beauty of public radio? It's a place where, you know, people from all different backgrounds can just kind of all come together and learn from each other.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's also the benefit of the way we approach this show and the way we try to center listener voices, listener perspectives. Because we may think as a team that we've got the range of thought around it pretty well covered. It's like, okay, yeah, these are the arguments we're seeing. And okay, get this voice. It never fails that someone will call in with a question, a perspective, an idea that we just simply didn't think of. And I think every day on the show, I'm learning something along with people who are listening. And the fact that it's listeners who are bringing that to the table, it's one of the most exciting parts of the show.
I want to ask you just like, what are you doing now to relax, when to take your mind off of things when you are really having a very stressful day? And also you mentioned we, that you moved. Who's the we in your life? Is it you and your husband? You, like, who moved to D.C.?
Yeah, so I'll start with the we. It's my husband, Alejandro, and our two dogs, Misha and Pasha, who are just both adorable and they drive me crazy. little fluff balls, little, they're hilarious. Anyway, that's a whole other conversation. So yeah, the two of us and our dogs. And in terms of relaxing, so I turn to physical activity quite a bit. We walk a lot, the dogs and I, like when I get home from work, after I'm done with all of my editorial calls, we pack it up, let's go walking. So we typically, weather allowing, we walk between 2 and 4 miles every day. And then I box. I box. Yeah, I've been boxing for years now. And
do you have a coach that works with you so you don't hurt yourself, or tell me about it?
So I've been training for years. And before the pandemic, well, as the pandemic was happening, my husband said, "I have a feeling we're not going to be going to any gyms anytime soon." So he's did a whole setup. We were doing CrossFit as well. So he did a whole CrossFit setup for us with, you know, barbells and weights and the whole nine yards. And then he, for my birthday, bought me a heavy bag. So I have a heavy bag at home and I'm able to continue boxing, and it's incredibly cathartic and exhausting, but it's like exactly the thing that I need.
That's great. He's a keeper.
He is 100% a keeper.
That's a good husband.
He's like, "You need to hit something. So I'm going to buy you a heavy bag." So that, and also just like transparently, I have a therapist. I have a place where I can every week just talk and talk about the things I need to talk about in a completely unfiltered manner. For me, it's very important to have that space because as a journalist, I'm very careful about what I say. I'm very careful about how and what I communicate. And so having a space where I can be less careful is really important.
So when you were seeking out a therapist, how did you choose someone? What is that process like? And are you happy with the choice that you landed on?
Yeah. So for me, it was important to have a therapist who was Black, who was a woman. And a friend of mine turned me on to a website. It's called Therapy for Black Girls, if I'm remembering. And so I went through that website and just looked at different people and kind of their modalities, the modalities they use in therapy, and landed on a couple of people and had some initial conversations until I found someone who I thought was a good fit for what I needed. And I've been really, I've been really happy with her. And it's always interesting, you know, I had a long time therapist when I was in Michigan, and when I moved to Chicago, I wasn't able to maintain that just because of state licensing things. Mm-hmm. And so establishing a new relationship with someone was great here.
I know a lot of Black people right now, myself included, we've been talking a lot about exhaustion because there's been so much, you know, emphasis now, this push for racial equity and just this new awakening, this awareness. Oh, my goodness, there's racial injustice. And so I did a show shortly after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis about what a lot of Black people, Black women in particular, were experiencing with exhaustion and how to communicate with many of their white friends on how their white friends can be allies. And I'm just curious, did you go through that, a little bit of that this summer as well, with like lots of emails and phone calls and text messages? How are you, Jen? And like, Jen, you know, what book do you think I should read? How were you impacted by that?
So we had a really specific experience with our CrossFit community. So we started doing CrossFit when we moved to Chicago. It wasn't something I'd done before we moved there. And it, when you're an adult and you move to a new place, building community, I think it's harder. You know, we had a really wonderful community in Michigan. And so we had to sort of rebuild our friend base when we moved to the Chicago area, and we found a gym we attended there. And you know, build a really lovely circle of people. And there, it's way too much to go into, but the short version is that the person who was the founder of that, of CrossFit, said some things that were just really beyond the pale. And so we had to make a decision about whether we were going to continue to be a part of that community while that person was involved. And this is not a community that's particularly diverse, I would say, generally speaking.
The CrossFit community?
Yeah. And so we had to have some really difficult conversations with people about the why we were deciding to step back. And it was challenging because it was, it was any time you have to explain why something hurts you, and when it would seem that why you're hurt would be very obvious, it costs something, I think, personally. When you sit across from someone who you care about, who you call a friend, who you love, who you respect, and you have to explain why something that seems so basic to you, that doesn't seem at all complicated to you, why it hurts you at a soul level. And there's an inability to understand that from the other person. There's just a lot of pain. There's pain with that. And for me, I mean, the place that I've gotten to with it, and I've been fortunate in that I have a really lovely circle of people that I've gained through my personal life, through my professional life, where I don't have to do a lot of that explaining, which is
right.
Wonderful.
You can pick up the conversation at a different place.
Yeah. But for the folks who I've had to explain it to, I've reached a point where I've realized it's okay for me to put a limit on the amount of explaining I do. And that's been a difficult place for me to get to, mostly because I think of my religious background. My father was a minister, and the way I saw them practice this issue in particular around race and racism, he and my mother had what I would describe as an unending supply of grace that apparently I did not inherit. I didn't get it. But I also wonder sometimes what that unending supply of grace cost them and what it continues to cost my mother, who is still living. And so I've made a different choice, I guess, is what I'll say, in that I'm willing to have a good faith conversation with people. My expectation about shifting people's hearts and minds, it's different than what my parents had, I think, and have. And the grace that I choose to extend comes to myself first, so that I'm okay, you know, so that I don't sacrifice so much that I can't come into this studio every day and do my job and do my work and be present for our listeners.
What has it been like for you to, you know, witness all of the attention that Vice President-elect Kamala Harris is receiving for being the first woman Vice President-elect, the first Black woman Vice President-elect? She has said in some of her speeches and on social media that Black women so often are overlooked and underestimated. That resonated a lot with me. I feel like most of my career, that's how I have felt.
I have very mixed emotions because on one hand, I can look at a Kamala Harris, look at a former President Obama, and I think about my niece, that same niece who was talking to me about cottagecore, and be really excited for her that this is her norm. Mm-hmm. It's not unusual, abnormal, in any way surprising that a woman or a person of color would ascend to the White House. That makes me very, very happy. At the same time, I think about how long it took to get here. And this is despite politics, right? This is not about political leanings. It's about the fact that we're still celebrating so many firsts. And there's something very sad about that to me as well. You know, it feels like we've made great progress in some ways, but that progress has taken so long. Mm-hmm. And so I have very mixed emotions about it.
It sounds like you really loved life in Chicago. You loved having your 2-hour show in Chicago. So how challenging has it been to go from doing a local show about a city that you know, communities you know, a place you live and you know, to doing a national show where you're focused on national topics? And it's, you know, is it different or not? I don't know.
Yeah, it is different. It is different. I mean, the thing I love about being at a local station, and I still am. I mean, the show is embedded in WAMU, but mm-hmm. we're doing national conversations. When I was at Michigan Radio, when I was at BEC, it's so easy to get to know the players and to really dig into complicated issues, but do it in a way that's so specific to place. And our audiences in Michigan and Chicago were both so engaged so engaged. Both Michigan and Chicago especially has this long history of organizing and activism, and people know their politics, and and there's these rich arts and culture communities. And so there was just so much to wrap your arms around, but do it in this way that felt place specific. And I cannot say enough about the importance of local journalism. Having a newsroom that can talk specifically to the issues of the community in which it's based, it's essential. It's essential. There are things that you as a host locally, you're going to be able to do things that I can't do because you just have the wealth of knowledge about that area and a specificity that I will not have as someone in DC. And that's something that I love. I love it. And sometimes I miss it. What we do try to do on the show that I think is important is while we're having these sort of big picture issues and big picture conversations and talking about what it means for the nation as a whole, we try to partner with member stations a fair amount so that we can bring some of that local specificity to the conversation. And so, if we're talking about an issue in Minnesota, reaching out to the reporter who's been covering that issue from NPR, and not just sort of like having this outsider's view, this DC view of what's happening in Minnesota. Let's talk to a reporter who's actually reporting on this. And I think that it also helps our audience, whether they're listening in California or they're listening in Florida, better wrap their heads around the issue because we are able to make it place specific and connect those dots. Okay, what does this conversation mean for me where I'm listening? It's a lot easier to do that when we create that sense of place. So I hope that I'm bringing some of that love for local journalism to the show. Our show, I think, was already doing it well, but I'm a big believer in talking about what's happening, not just on the coast, but what's all that country in between the coasts. Really right. Think that's important.
Here's a question from one of our members of the audience. This person would like to know, do you ever feel conflicted about airing an interview with someone that you do not feel ethically aligned with?
The way I think about this work is it's my job to be an advocate for you, the person listening to the show. And so when we talk about personal ethics, I mean, there are definitely lines in the sand for me personally and lines in the sand for us as a show. There's certain things that we're not going to debate. We're not going to talk about whether or not climate science is real. Not going to do it. We're not going to talk about whether or not racism and systemic racism is real. It's not debatable. There's historical context for that. There are laws in the books we can look to explain all of that, right? There's certain things we're not going to debate. Where it gets more tricky is when you have someone who believes very deeply that their perspective is right. And what I have to ask myself is, are they wrong to feel the way they do, right? So it's like, if you just have, I'm trying to think of a good example. I'll give you a for instance. When I was in Chicago, one of the last interviews I did was with the head of the police union there. And he was newly elected. And this was a gentleman who had been elected as head of the police union while he was being placed on desk duty for, I want to be careful here because I don't want to misstate, but he'd broken police policy. And so he was on desk duty and was elected the head of the union. Mm. He'd posted offensive things on social media. his rhetoric was such that there wasn't space to even debate whether there were any police reforms that were necessary, whether there were use of force issues in Chicago. And so when we were offered this interview with him, we had to have a conversation as a team about how to approach this. Mm-hmm. Because there were lots of things that were problematic about, you know, what he said, what he posted. But was it a service to our listeners to have the conversation? And we came down that yes, it was. This is a service to our listeners. This was a conversation we were going to be having just after George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis. I was personally just troubled because it's like, okay, I don't want to give space in this time when everybody was on edge to further inflame what's right, you know, what's right there on the edge. So what we ended up doing, I did the interview, we pre-taped it, and then we broke it into chunks and had a criminal justice reporter, as I was going into the interview, when he would say something outlandish, we would come out and I would say, okay, let's fact check this.
This sounds familiar to me, Jen.
So ethically, I was very concerned about whether or not doing that interview and airing it would cause harm when people were already so keyed up. But I think the way we were able to do it quieted that concern for me, because we were able to fact check it in real time, but also give people some insight into some of the thinking.
Right, because you want to give people an opportunity to express their viewpoints and, you know, to help people understand, like, why does this person feel the way that they do, right? And you don't have to agree with them, but you understand, like, why they so firmly believe, like, their version of the truth. So let's talk about today. I mean, how are members of the media, I mean, how should we be tackling how to report and talk about what's happening now after the presidential election, with our current president still not conceding, and you know, dealing with statements that, you know, many people feel are not true, not based on evidence. Like, what are we supposed to do?
So I think the first thing we need to do is approach all of this with care, right? I think that if you are part of a team, and I think most of us are, this should be an active conversation. This shouldn't be something like, okay, we're just going to do it the way we've already always done it, and let's just forge ahead. Because I think we are human beings, and we have to be an active conversation with one another, with our editors, with our producers, about how we get it right. I think we cannot flinch from the facts. I think we cannot, we have to be really careful about this sort of both otherism, like, oh, they're just these, you know, this other side, oh, who knows what they're talking about. No, we have to acknowledge that there are people who are on either sides of this spectrum. And even on both of those sides, there is nuance within those groups, right? So I think that painting America as if it exists in a binary of its citizenry is just false. Mm-hmm. That's just false. It's wrongheaded. And if we do that, we miss out on the opportunity to have more nuanced conversations about what America is right now. So that's a one, right? And then I think we cannot. It's the same thing. I come back to this climate science thing, right? Where it's like, well, some scientists say climate science, you know, the world isn't warming. That's, we can't do
this
that.
This data,
that's,
we know.
Not responsible. Right. That's not responsible.
Right.
So as we're moving through these conversations, having that, you know, top of mind, let's make sure we're not doing harm. Mm-hmm. Let's make sure we're not doing harm. Let's also make sure we're not missing nuance. if we get into this idea that America exists on a binary, I think we're doing it wrong. This is an incredibly complex country. People have complex opinions. And sometimes the things you hear people say, a single person, it seems like they're in contradiction to each other coming out of the same person. We have to take the time to tease that out and not act as if, and this is the benefit of having a talk show, I think you'd agree, Angela, just because we talk about something on a Tuesday doesn't mean we can't talk about it again on Friday. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, just because you talked about it once doesn't mean you don't need to revisit that conversation or continue that conversation with the people who are listening. One and done does not do it in this environment. I don't think it ever did it. But especially now, mm-hmm. we cannot treat it as if, well, we talked about that last week. Yeah, you know what? We need to talk about it again.
Well, even just with the pandemic coverage, I mean, we've learned so much more now about how COVID-19 patients, you know, the symptoms that they're showing and what's happening, you know, weeks and months after the diagnosis. And the doctors that we interviewed in March and April and May, that's a whole other interview if you talk to them today. So revisiting some topics that are still just, you know, complicated is, you know, something I think a talk show host can do. I want to bring in another question from a member of the audience. This person would like to know, Jen White, how has your media consumption changed in the last decade? Where do you think media and journalism are headed in the next 10 years? So what do you listen to? I did read that you enjoy listening to podcasts and that you, I know, I'm sure you have to read a lot in preparing for your show each day.
Yeah. I mean, I can't give you the full list. I read a lot of stuff. You know, major newspapers. I listen to NPR a lot. I'll be honest. I do. Fox News. I mean, like I listen to a wide variety and watch a wide variety of sources. And part of that is just to get a sense of, you know, how conversations are happening mm-hmm. more broadly.
So the second part of that question is where do you see journalism headed in the next 10 years?
I'll tell you where I'm concerned journalism is heading and where I hope it's heading. I am concerned about the ongoing consolidation of media organizations. I'm concerned about the loss of local newsrooms. Deeply concerned about that. I think about even like a pandemic setting when what's happening in your city, in your county, in your state around pandemic issues is so important. Like you can listen to national news media and that may be helpful, but knowing what's happening in your city mm-hmm. is what you really need to know. And that's local journalism. That's right. Local journalists on the ground tracking all of that. Mm-hmm. What I hope is that we see people continuing to invest in local newsrooms. Whether it's through public radio or it's through, you know, a subscription to your local newspaper, or it's a newsroom, a new startup. We saw a few of those in Chicago, Black Club Chicago, which was it came out of DNA Info when that went belly up, and this new media organization sprung up from the reporters just on the ground being like, we need this kind of coverage. I hope to see more support of those kinds of enterprises so that local journalism isn't lost, because it's not enough to have these national organizations trying to cover what's happening in your community. It's not enough.
Right. You want to know about the local restaurants, like who's struggling, like, oh, who's offering takeout now, or who's got the outdoor patio with the warmers. You want to know about like where I can go to get tested now for COVID-19. Right. And we have seen,
but also coverage of like state legislatures.
Yeah.
You know, we focus so much on national politics, but what's happening in your state legislature is going to have more of an impact on your day-to-day life. And there are so few legislative reporters right now who are like embedded in these state legislatures and talking about laws that are being passed in your name, on your behalf, And people don't really know. People don't really know what's going on. So having that kind of coverage is just, I can't tell you how important it is.
All right. I want to make sure we talk about Detroit. You're a native mm-hmm. of Detroit. You graduated from the University yeah. of Michigan. What was growing up like for you in Detroit?
Oh, wow. I grew up on the west side of Detroit in, it was a working class neighborhood. Most of the families there worked at, you know, General Motors, Ford, or Chrysler. And I loved growing up in Detroit. Our neighborhood was really close knit. You know, it was kickball in the street all summer until the streetlights came on and everybody knew everybody else, and the families were, you know, all the parents looked out for other people's kids. It's kind of, that was just the block I grew up on. That's how it was. I went to Detroit Public Schools and had a great experience there. And I was really fortunate to grow up in a city where there was a rich arts and culture legacy. And my mom used to take us to the Detroit Institute of Arts when I was a kid. She'd pack a lunch for us. This is like during the summer, and we'd go to the DIA or the Detroit Historical Museum or the Detroit Science Institute, and we would spend the whole day there. She would basically just let us go, like go explore. This space belongs to you two.
It's you and your sister? Just,
there were seven of us. So it wasn't all seven at the same
goodness.
Time. But I'm one of seven.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, big family. And so this was more the set that grew up with me, my older brother and sister, because the older ones were, you know, in high school mm-hmm. and college by that point. But just having places where I was exposed to art, where I could literally sit in front of a painting and just stare at it for half an hour and take it all in, if that was what I wanted to do. And it was available to me.
As a child, you were able to do that?
As a child. There's one specific nook that is part of part of a church that was rebuilt in the DIA. And it's like a prayer nook almost, with beautiful stained glass. And I would just sit in there.
I don't want to see children by stained glass alone in a museum. That makes me nervous. You all must have been good.
We were well behaved children. But it was also just being in that space around these works of art, and feeling like I had a place there. There was never a destructive thought in my mind. It was just something. It's hard to explain, something really powerful about feeling like that belonged to me, like that space also belonged to me. And probably one of the most challenging things about being in DC right now, one of the things I was looking forward to most was exploring
the museum,
you know, all of the Smithsonian museums, and we haven't been able to do that. The museums have a very deep, deep place in my heart, and a lot of that I trace back to those, to my childhood in Detroit and my mother being mindful of the importance of us being in those spaces and knowing that us feeling comfortable in those spaces and like those spaces were for us. They were for us too.
So, you know, public media is under a lot of scrutiny right now for its coverage of communities of color. Mm-hmm. And frankly, also how journalists of color are and have been treated within newsrooms. And you've been in public media now for a while. What are your thoughts? I mean, are you seeing improvement, or what do you think will be important for progress?
I think what's going to be important for progress, and I've been asked this question a lot lately, is the conversation we're having 5 or 10 years from now. What I've seen happen over my 20 years in public media is this sort of cyclical conversation where we talk about it and then it sort of dies off. We have to be committed to making this a permanent conversation, not a one-time conversation, but the conversation about how we cover communities of color and other marginalized groups. That's not a one-off. That's not a you know, we're going to have a seminar about this and then we move on. We need to be having that conversation continuously, along with all the other editorial conversations that we're having in our newsroom. I think the same thing goes for how we're staffing our newsrooms. Having a one-time session on how to diversify your newsroom is not going to get us there. This needs to be a conversation we're having all the time. And if we don't do that, and if we don't put actionable steps, attach those to the conversations we're having, we're going to be right back here in 5 or 10 years. It'll just continue to be a conversation rather than actual movement toward change. And so my hope is that in 10 years, nobody will have to ask me this question, but I think it requires sustained commitment, benchmarking, and a willingness not to allow fatigue to set in, but rather to say, this too is who we are. And so we have to treat it like we treat everything else and just make it part of our DNA.
And, you know, the other conversation, and it's very related, you know, how do we attract more listeners of color? Well, it's tied to having more journalists of color, you know, here in our newsroom and also in management positions, and just really being focused on, you know, being able to tell everyone's story, but having the right people having a seat at the table to make that possible.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a place where, again, local newsrooms play a really important role. But I think we also, as stations, as shows, we cannot be afraid of what people have to say to us. The work we do should not be a one-sided conversation. If we ask our audience, what are we missing? We have to be willing to hear them and to act on what they say. Before I left Chicago, we did a series of listening sessions with communities that we felt we hadn't been covering well. And in the space of a two-hour conversation, we probably came away with at least a dozen story ideas that we then turned around and acted on immediately.
I'm sure.
Immediately. We said, okay, these are great ideas. These we can move on right now. Put them on the calendar. But it takes that willingness to actually go out, reach out, listen, and then act on it. Not in 6 months. Just get about the business of getting it done.
What can listeners and just, you know, public radio members do to get involved in improving how well public media covers these issues?
It goes without saying that your financial support of local newsrooms is incredibly important. But I would also say that, you know, don't be afraid to speak up. If there is a story idea or something you think we're not getting quite right, or something you think we're missing, tell us. The 1A audience has no problem communicating with us through every means that they have. But so often that voice that spoke up and said, I didn't really want to call in about this, but I just feel like it's really important. That perspective, again, gives us that crucial nuance that we were missing, because best of intentions, we're not going to be able to see every piece of a story, no matter how hard we try.
Right.
And so you as a listener play a really important role in helping us see the things we're not seeing.
That was Jen White, who became the new host of the national talk show 1A this past summer. I interviewed her last week as part of a special event made possible by Fredrickson and Byron. Please join me tomorrow at 11 in the morning for a live conversation on sleep and seasonal affective disorder, also known as SAD. How will we tackle that this winter? This conversation was produced by NPR's Elizabeth Dunbar. Thanks for tuning in. Stay safe, everybody.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-227-6000 or tweet us at Angela Davis NPR. And if you missed us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. Thanks for listening.